Well, labor relations have certainly been in the news lately. And on the show today, we'll talk about what you need to know. I'm Jill Najoe, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. We're welcoming labor and employment attorney Michael Kent to the show. Mike has taught employment law and labor relations at Madison Area Technical College for 20 years now. Are you wondering how all these changes will affect you? Do you have questions about your rights as an employee or an employer? We want to hear from you, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And just a reminder, our discussion today is intended as general information and should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So I would imagine it's kind of busy for people who are in any kind of employment law. I mean, there have been so many changes in just the last 2 weeks.
Yes, there have. It's a little bit dizzying to keep track of it. In addition to the executive orders that are being issued, then there's the various responses to executive orders. So some of these orders end up getting enjoined. Other ones are being challenged through other means, and it's an exciting time to be an employment attorney.
That's one way to put it. Very positive outlook. Well, let's just take a look at what's been going on in Washington. What are these deferred resignations all about?
Okay, so the deferred resignation offer that's been in the news recently, it was given to some federal employees on January 28th, and it essentially told them that we're giving you the option to resign from your position, but with a deferred applicability date. And that deferred date, I believe, is September 30th of this year. And if you accept this deferred resignation offer, then we will not make you return to work. There's the backdrop against which this offer was made is that there is a lot of talk right now about ending telework and remote work for federal employees, requiring them to return to work in person at their headquarters offices. There's been some conversation about relocating some of the headquarters offices of a number of different federal agencies. Then there's been additional talk about shrinking the size of the federal workforce and reclassifying a number of federal employees from their current classification in the civil service to positions that don't have the same kinds of protections. So there's a lot of change on the horizon. And so against that backdrop, this email was sent out, and employees were given until this week, I think it's February 6th, to decide whether or not they wanted to accept this agreement.
How is that different from a buyout, Mike?
Okay, so the exact offer that's included with this agreement is a little bit uncertain. What the email itself says is that if you accept this deferred resignation offer, you don't have to comply with the return to work rules, and you will be exempted from any workforce cuts between now and the time of your the effective date of your resignation. The FAQs that have appeared on the Office of Personnel Management's website sort of characterize it differently. There's some suggestion that employees who accept the offer don't have to report to work at all if they want to. They can, you know, essentially they're getting a paid vacation. And so there's a little bit of inconsistency about what the exact nature of the offer is. And then there have been some concerns noted by different players, including the American Federation of Governmental Employees has noted that, you know, if this is a buyout offer, then it's one that probably exceeds the president's authority under the law. Under the civil service regulations, a buyout offer cannot be in excess of $25,000. And for a lot of employees, if it was really the case that they just got to stay home from work, then the value of that buyout would be substantially in excess of $25,000. And so in response to that, the Office of Personnel Management said that, well, we're going to look at putting people onto paid administrative leave for that period. Not necessarily that they have to do that. That's another element of the buyout offer was, or the, not the buyout offer, the deferred resignation offer. I want to make sure I get my terminology right. Correct there. was that your job duties may be distributed to other employees. They may be changed. You may be asked to help train a replacement or train people on how to do your work. So there's a lot of caveats that are in there. So as soon as they said, well, we're just going to we'll put people on paid administrative leave, then somebody brought up, well, but the Administrative Leave Act limits paid administrative leave to 10 days in any calendar year. So you can't really put these employees on paid administrative leave either. The other concern that's been brought up is because the government is currently operating under a continuing resolution we don't necessarily know whether or not this deferred resignation program will end up being funded when Congress comes back together to do either another continuing resolution or some other budget action in March. So there isn't really a guarantee that there will be money available to pay for the program one way or the other. So right now there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly how this would work. And also what exactly the offer is. That's kind of the situation on the ground as of today on this offer.
That may change. You just never know.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So if someone came to you and they were a federal employee, what would you advise them to do?
Ooh, well, here's maybe another aspect of this that is worth noting. The president's office indicated that they anticipate that maybe 5 to 10% of the federal workforce will take advantage of this offer, and that would be a meaningful number of people. There's roughly 2 million federal employees in the federal civil service that received this offer. The total federal workforce, by the way, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 million, give or take. The federal civil service is just one of five different groups that are all considered government employees. So there's the civil service, there's the military, there's the post office, then there's contract workers, and there's grant workers. And so of the total, 10 or 11 million federal employees, only roughly 2 million are in the civil service and are impacted by this notice. But among those 2 million employees, the Office of Personnel Management indicates that every year they hire between 200 and 300,000 employees, which means that the normal turnover rate within the federal civil service is roughly 10%. So if you were one of those employees who was going to retire anyway or was otherwise thinking of leaving, go for it. No, uh-huh. No harm here. If you are, however, somebody that would like to keep your job and was anticipating continuing employment, I would say that until the questions are answered about it, I would be reluctant to accept it. Now, if they clarify it, and they make more firm representations in the offer itself, then something for someone to consider. But right now, the uncertainty means that you kind of don't know what you're actually getting in exchange for your resignation, and so that for that reason, I would urge caution.
Okay, well, that seems fair. How are state employees affected by this? Because I know this is for federal employees, right?
That's correct. So this does not. There are potentially in the future, if they pursue workforce reduction actions among the grant or contract sections of the workforce, then you could potentially start to see some people who work for the state impacted, ones that are funded by grant positions or funded by contracts. So that would really be the only way that that would start to impact state employees. For the time being, this offer and the various things that arise around this offer really only strictly apply to federal employees, and then more specifically federal employees in the federal civil service.
Okay. And do the federal civil servant group, do they have a union? Is this, and if so, how is the union reacting to this?
Well, the union's not thrilled.
Well, gee, I wonder why.
Yes. The biggest federal union, I might have mentioned before, is the American Federation of Governmental Employees. They have about 800,000 members. They include members of the federal civil service. They also include some employees in Washington, D.C., but they've advised their members not to accept the offer. There are other large unions representing federal employees as well, and they are also resisting the buyout offer. What's been reported actually is that they're saying it's having the effect of galvanizing employees against leaving. So I don't know how that will end up playing out. At least, well, two major federal employee unions have already filed lawsuits against some of the other executive orders that have come out, notably the one impacting the reclassification of federal employees into what's called Schedule F. So within the federal civil service, there's different levels of job security. There's different levels of job protection. If you are in the normal competitive service or in the merit service, then you can only be dismissed for cause. There are certain due process protections that apply. You have certain property interests, constitutionally protected property interests in your job. So there's much more job security, much more certainty about your continued employment if you're a member of the regular civil service. If you move into one of these policy-related positions, then those positions really serve at the pleasure of the president. And so you're much more like an employee at will. In those circumstances, you have less protection against being released for, well, any reason or no reason as soon as your services are no longer desired by the president, then you can be released and you don't have the same kind of due process protections.
Well, we are talking with Michael Kent, a labor and employment attorney, and for 20 years he's taught employment law and labor relations at Madison Area Technical College. We're talking right now about some of the new employee regulations coming out of Washington, but if you have questions about your employment or as an employee, please give us a call. The lines are open, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. I hope you can stay with us. Coming up at noon, we're going to change topics quite a bit and talk about shipwrecks on the Great Lakes and the upcoming Ghost Ships Festival in Manitowoc. But right now, we are talking about employee and employer law. Employment law, I guess, is the term, right, Mike?
Yes.
Well, Stacy emailed to say that they are a physician and the largest healthcare company in Madison, I'm assuming at. Stacy has two questions. Stacy said they do not get a protected break to use the bathroom or eat during their work day, and everyone else in the office takes mandated breaks while the MD has no break and keeps seeing patients. Is this legal? And then question number two, our MD compensation plan has changed from hourly to salary. If we don't work our contracted hours, say the individual were sick with COVID and missed a few days, the healthcare company employer asks that the MD either pick up shifts to make up for the days away for illness, or the employer takes money out of the paycheck. I was told by my employer that they are allowed to do this because of the MD's professional status. She said if a teacher calls in, they don't have money taken out of their paycheck. Is this legal? Lots of stuff there, Mike.
There's a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
So let me, I'll first touch on what I can remember of the first question, and that is with respect to the ability to take restroom breaks and other breaks. So there is no federal law that requires any particular number of breaks during any shift. There is also no law in Wisconsin for adult workers that requires your employer to give you really any kind of a break. There is a recommendation that if an employee works more than 6 hours, that they receive at least a 30-minute lunch break, but there isn't like a minimum number of breaks that an employee is entitled to during the workday. Now, there's a caveat on that for purposes of bathroom breaks, because there are regulations through OSHA, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch whether this employee works for a public employer or a private employer. If it's a public employer, then there's state regulations that would apply. If it's a private employer, then the OSHA regulations would likely apply. And there are OSHA regulations regarding allowing workers to take restroom breaks. So if you're being denied the opportunity to use the restroom at all, that would probably be worth talking to someone about, another employment attorney. I can't advise you specifically about your issue here, and it wouldn't be ethically responsible for me to do so based on just the content of a sure. telephone call. But there are some rules that may apply to that situation, at least. With respect to the equity of breaks throughout the office, there isn't a requirement that your employer treat all employees the same with respect to the breaks it gives, unless the you're being treated differently based on some sort of protected classification. So if they let all the men take breaks, but they don't let the women take breaks, for example, or if there's some other potentially discriminatory effect taking place, then, you know, again, there could be a legal impact. Otherwise, again, your employer, if you're unless you're working under some sort of employment contract, there's no rule about treating everyone the same. So the second question, again, to the extent that I can recall, it had to do with an employer withholding pay for days not worked for a salaried employee. And that's an interesting question that has come up a couple of times in the context of my professional practice here. And so in order to qualify as a FLISA-exempt employee, meaning that you don't have to be paid overtime if you work for more than 40 hours a week, among the requirements that they have statutory exemptions for certain types of employee. So doctors, you mentioned, there's teachers, other types of professionals, there's managerial employees, confidential administrative employees can all fall under one of the statutory exemptions that allow a person to be exempted from the right to overtime. But in order to be what's called a FLISA-exempt employee, you have to be paid on a salaried basis. So being paid on a salaried basis, what that means is that you get paid the same amount of money each week, irrespective of the number of hours that you work. So if you're a true salary basis employee you make, whatever, let's call it $5,000 a week, that's a lot, but $5,000 a week, you get paid that $5,000 a week, whether you work 40 hours a week, whether you work 60 hours a week, or whether you work 30 hours a week. There are some limited exceptions for when an employee misses an entire day, and it's subject to a paid time off benefit plan. But that's the thing that kind of stuck out to me when you were describing that situation, is that are these people really being treated as salary basis employees under these circumstances?
She did say that that they were contracted hours. So could that be something in their contract that she signed that would say that if you are sick and don't fulfill the hours that we require of you, we can take money away from you?
Well, yeah, I mean, then I'd have to look at the contract itself. So And maybe I misheard because I got stuck focusing
no,
on the positions.
Yeah.
But if you're an hourly employee, then you're generally not entitled to be paid for hours that you don't work. And so if your contract is set up on an hourly basis.
And she's is salary at this point. It was hourly, now it's switched to salary. And so she said, if we don't work our contracted hours, say they missed days because they were sick, the company asks the doctors to either pick up shifts or make up for the days away for illness, or the employer will take money out of their paycheck.
Yeah. So that's, you're dancing around whether or not you're actually salary based at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So that situation is going to be involved enough, and it's going to require a careful reading of the contract. You probably need to talk to an attorney in their office and let them review the language of the contract to see exactly what's going on there.
Definitely. Well, good luck, Stacy, and thank you for the email. If you've got a question for Mike, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@wpr.org. So one of the other executive orders is the basically, they're dismantling all of the federal government's DEI programs. And just so you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion is what the DEI stands for. How's this being done, Mike?
So that was there have been a couple of executive orders on that topic. One of them is essentially an internal memo directing all the federal agencies to dismantle the DEI programs they have within the agency. The one that's probably the more substantive one is the one titled Ending Illegal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity. Now, that one, that's a doozy. Of the executive orders that have been filed so far, that one is probably, I want to say, well, it's hard to compare it to some of the ones impacting immigration, but from an employment perspective, that one is really big. And it did a couple of things. The one that's most relevant to non-federal employees is that it rescinded Executive Order 11246. Now, Executive Order 11246 has been in effect since the 1960s, and it has the requirement that anybody that is working on a federal contract or receiving money from the federal government through a contract has to maintain an affirmative action plan, specifically with respect to race, color, religion, and sex. So the rescission of Executive Order 11246 means that now federal contractors are no longer required to track applicants with respect to their demographic information. They're no longer required to prepare an annual affirmative action plan. And there are other elements of that executive order that are actually even more impactful than that. Now, this is one that we've spent an awful lot of time looking at and talking about. And among the reasons for it is that so the federal affirmative action requirements, they do include race, color, religion, sex, but they also include categories such as veteran status and disability status. Now, the requirements to maintain an affirmative action plan for disability status, that's a different law. That's Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act. And then the requirement to maintain an affirmative action plan for veterans is under VEVRA, the Vietnam-era Veterans Readjustment Act. All these public employers and federal contractors that had been maintaining these more expansive affirmative action plans now are still obligated to maintain affirmative action plans for disability and veterans, but are not required to maintain them for race and color and sex. The thing that makes this challenging, or at least just that aspect of the executive order, is that there's still a legal requirement to avoid disparate impact discrimination. So discrimination in employment can take two forms. There's disparate treatment and there's disparate impact. Disparate treatment is when a guy comes and hands me a job application and I say, I'm not going to hire you because you're black. That's disparate treatment. It's plainly illegal. It was made illegal under the McDonnell Douglas versus Green decision of the Supreme Court issued shortly after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed. Disparate impact discrimination is when I don't tell you directly that I'm not hiring you because you're a black person. It's instead I use some other measure that has the effect of discriminating against black people. So in the case that gave rise to it, Griggs v. Duke Power, Duke Power had a employment requirement that if you didn't have a high school diploma, you could never do anything other than work in their labor department, which was the lowest paying department in the power plant they were operating. And so at the time, not very many black people had a high school diploma. And so it had the effect of keeping black people out of the better paying jobs. And when this case was brought to court, it came out that, well, there isn't really anything about these higher paying jobs that really requires a high school diploma. You can do those jobs without having one. And so the high school diploma requirement really was just having the effect of keeping black people out of those better paying jobs. And so it was ruled to be illegal. And that's what became known as disparate impact discrimination. So that's the law of the land, and it's still the law of the land. So if you have a hiring practice that has the effect of screening out more black people than other demographic groups, for example, that's still illegal. That's still actionable. By eliminating the affirmative action requirement, companies now they're not required to keep track of whether or not not required to affirmatively keep track of whether or not their hiring practices are having a discriminatory effect, they're still on the hook for it. So a lot of companies and contractors still have an interest in monitoring their hiring practices, their promotion practices, their pay practice to make sure they're not creating that disparate impact because they're still on the hook for that. And the element of the Civil Rights Act, it's Title VI of the Civil Rights Act that requires federal contractors to not discriminate. Well, there's language in the regulations that still require that you can't use any sort of screening process or hiring that has the effect of discrimination based on race, color, national origin, et cetera. So the rules are still there, but the mechanism for making sure you're following them is really there. Kind of what went away.
Oh,
so.
My gosh. Oh, okay. Well, let's go to a different topic here. We've got Callie and Madison with a question. Go ahead, Callie.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling just to ask about a non-disclosure agreement that I chose to sign once I was fired from a nonprofit a year ago. I'm just wondering, because now I kind of wish I hadn't signed it, just because it, I think the agreement itself is about 6 pages. It's just, it's so all-inclusive that it feels like I would never be able to even mention this company's name, not that I want to, and I certainly don't have an interest in disparaging it, but I made the choice to sign it, and I'm just wondering, it seems like it's forever, but is there any way to get out of a non-disclosure agreement? What are your recommendations, or is it just it is what it is?
So I'm gonna lump the non-disclosure agreement in with another type of typical agreement that people sign when they're leaving an employer, and that's a non-compete agreement as well. And non-compete agreements recently have sort of come into disfavor in the court, that the courts have shown a willingness to limit them really to only the minimum that is necessary to protect the legitimate business interests of the company. And so if you draft a non-compete agreement that's too expansive, then you run the risk that the court's not going to uphold it. Now, in the case of a non-disclosure agreement, well, that's a contract between you and your employer. There are certain bases upon which a contract can be nullified. If the contract is unconscionable, for example, that could be a basis to void it, or to at least void portions of it. This one is going to be another one where it's really going to depend on the circumstances. It's going to depend on what is the legitimate business interest of the company in the non-disclosure agreement. Does the non-disclosure agreement cross over into any areas of public law? Because that's another thing that courts will look at is, you know, have you agreed not to disclose to the federal government something in a whistleblowing capacity? Because is when you start to cross over into public law, like discrimination protections or whistleblower protections and things like that, then there are other bases upon which to review the contract. And so in order to really provide good advice on this, an attorney would need to know not only, you know, what the job was, what the responsibilities of the job were, what the circumstances were around the departure, and then what the contents are of the non-disclosure agreement to see if any of these potential exceptions apply to it. It's very possible that they don't, but there are some exceptions that exist out there under the law for the enforceability of those kinds of contractual agreements. So, I guess it's worth talking to a lawyer over.
Okay, thank you for that question, Callie. Excuse me. Mike Ted emailed. He said his supervisor wants him to sign a performance improvement plan that he doesn't think is fair. What are his options?
Well, there's a lot of additional information that would probably fall into that. So is the person, are they under an employment contract? Are they a public sector employee or a private sector employee? So a performance improvement plan, where you frequently see those is in work environments where there is some sort of job protection, where the employer may need just cause in order to terminate an employee. And so the performance improvement plan is documentation of a performance deficiency, and it's giving the employee an opportunity to correct the deficiency. And then in the event that the employee doesn't correct the deficiency, then it creates just cause to discipline or terminate the employee. They are not in and of themselves considered to be disciplinary. They are really, they are advising the employee of this is the specific performance disability that is being observed. And a performance improvement plan will also generally include, you know, what are the standards that we're going to expect you to meet in order to cure the deficiency. So a performance improvement plan may say, you know, we've noticed that you come into work, 10 minutes late every day. So that's the identification of the deficiency. It'll then say, you know, to cure this deficiency, you know, you will show up to work on time every day. So they say what success looks like, or what curing the deficiency looks like. In terms of what part of the plan you don't agree with, if you don't agree with the deficiency that's been identified, yeah, that's a little tricky because, ultimately it's your supervisor's evaluation of your performance that's important. If it's just factually inaccurate, that would be something to note. Usually there is an opportunity on a performance improvement plan for the employee to include some sort of a statement. If not, if there's nothing like that on the plan itself, then what I would suggest is write up your concerns about the plan and provide them to your employer in the form of a letter, so that you've documented, you know, these are the concerns that I have about this plan. I think that's probably the best thing that you can do at that point. And if you're an at-will employee, it's going to be tricky, because if you're at-will, your employer can fire you for any reason or no reason, as long as it's not an illegal reason.
Mike, can you explain what an at-will employee is?
Oh, sure. So that's kind of the default state in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country. An at-will employee means that you don't have a employment contract for any particular term of employment, and that for both the employee and the employer, the duration of the agreement is just as long as you decide to keep it going. So from your employer's perspective, if they've hired you at will, means that if I need you for the next 3 weeks and then I don't need you anymore, I can terminate you at the end of those 3 weeks, and that's it. I haven't violated any contracts, haven't violated any agreements. You can be let go because there's no expectation of continuing employment with an at-will relationship. From the employee's perspective, it means you can quit whenever you want to with no worries that you're going to be accused of breaching a contract or causing some sort of injury to the company. If you decide you want to quit, your employer might say, well, we really want 2 weeks' notice, but if you're at will, you're not legally obligated to provide that. You have the same ability that the employer does to end the relationship whenever.
And I would think that then that is put in front of the employee at the time they are hired, that they are at will.
The default assumption is that you are at will unless you have some other agreement in place. So the opposite of the at will employee is one that has some sort of contractual expectation of continued employment. And usually when you have that sort of contractual expectation, then it will include a provision in it that says you can only be disciplined or discharged for cause, for just cause. This is actually one of the big things that's impacting the federal workers right now, and the attempt to reclassify some of those federal workers from these protected classifications where you can only be disciplined or discharged for cause into positions where that for cause protection doesn't exist. Usually you see that in either a unionized environment. Some professionals have employment contracts, but it's more the exception than the rule. Unless you have an employment contract, then the default assumption is that you're just at will. They don't have to come out and say you're at will.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We are talking with Michael Kent. He's a labor and employment attorney. And for 20 years, Mike has taught employment law and labor relations at Madison Technical College. If you ever got a question for us, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Tomorrow we're going to talk about chocolates, jewelry, and flowers. And you can join us for this Valentine's tutorial about starting at 11 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now we are talking about employee law. And Mike, we didn't get a chance yet to talk about Title IX. I know that's a big topic too. But just briefly, why don't you tell us what it was struck down just recently. So what does that mean? And what is actually, talk about what Title IX is briefly, and then what it means that it's been struck down.
Well, so the Title IX law itself is still intact. What was struck down recently were some changes to the regulations implementing Title IX. So Title IX, it's the of the Education Amendments Act, is the federal law that says that in educational opportunities, including participation in sports, a school is not allowed to discriminate on the basis of sex. The regulations implementing Title IX include the procedures for conducting an investigation. Additionally, what can constitute sex discrimination under Title IX. And so it's a kind of a big deal for schools in particular. So grade schools, high schools, colleges are all impacted by that. This one has been kind of a ping pong ball. So for a number of years, the Title IX regulations were just kind of set at a status quo. And then during the first Trump administration, the Department of Education rewrote the Title IX regulations. And what they did is they somewhat changed the definition of what constituted discrimination. They added different requirements with respect to the investigation procedure, the hearing procedure, things like the right to face-to-face cross-examination of witnesses and things like that. So that became the law, or that became the binding regulations as of 2020. Then the Biden administration, during its tenure, again revised the regulations to Title IX. And so they once again updated them, and they made some additional changes. And among the changes that they proposed for the 2024 versions, one is it expanded the definition of sex for purposes of sex-based harassment to include gender identity and sexual orientation. That's consistent with the Bostock decision that came down a couple of years back here. It expanded the ability to engage in informal resolution. It changed the definition of what constituted harassment, and it added protections for pregnant students. Now, I think it was primarily the inclusion of the protections based on gender identity that I think drew the challenges. And so shortly after those regulations were released, they were challenged in court, and they ended up being frozen. Court issued injunctions in a number of states. Ultimately, a court issued an injunction that covered a good portion of the colleges in the University of Wisconsin system. And so that update was somewhat frozen. Now, after the election, another court ruled on the 2024 regulations, and it just it struck them down nationwide. And because the change in the administration, it's unlikely that the administration will continue to defend the 2024 rules, so they'll just go back to the 2020 rules. But one of the most substantial differences, besides the inclusion or exclusion of sexual orientation, gender identity, and pregnant students, is the definition of what constitutes sexual harassment. The old rules said that it's conduct that is sufficiently severe or pervasive so as to meaningfully disrupt an individual's ability to participate in the educational institution. So the 2020 rules kind of raised the bar on that, that instead of it being either severe or pervasive, now it has to be severe and pervasive and objectively offensive. So it's if you have a very severe incident under the old rules, one severe incident could rise to the level of sexual harassment. But under the new rules, severity by itself doesn't meet the test. It also has to be pervasive. It also has to be objectively offensive. And that was something that was then changed back again in the 2024 rules. But now that those rules have been struck down, we're back to the 2020 rules, which are a higher burden to meet if you're a complainant for Title IX.
And who ultimately decides that? The court?
Who decides if a Title IX complaint is made?
Yeah.
So when a Title IX complaint is made, it's an administrative process. It has to be investigated by the institution. Then the institution, if it ends up going to hearing, it actually goes before a hearing examiner, an independent hearing examiner. Ultimately, if somebody really disagrees with the outcome, it can be appealed to a court of law. But in terms of if you were talking about the regulations, who decides which regulations are going to be in effect, that has been determined by the court at this point. So.
Okay. We did get a call from Roberto in Hilbert. He couldn't stay with us, but he said that recently he started a new job and was asked to sign a document about the need for personal protective equipment. But then he was informed that he, as an employee, needed to buy or provide that equipment on their own. Roberto is wondering why he should have to pay for PPE for a job that requires it.
Okay. Well, that's a very good question. This is another one of these employee at will versus employee on a employment contract differences. So the employer is required under OSHA to require PPE for certain circumstances. They are not in many cases required to provide it. They're merely required to ensure that it's being used. So like steel-toed shoes, for example, a very common example. There are a lot of jobs that require steel-toed shoes, and a lot of employers require their employees to buy them on their own. Now, a number of jobs will give you a stipend for that. For example, they'll they'll say, we'll give you like $100 every 2 years to get steel-toed boots. And you know, if you end up having to buy it yourself, it's technically tax deductible, but it usually doesn't add up to very much. There are going to be other circumstances where the PPE is probably sufficient or rather expensive or technical enough that there's really no choice but for the employer to provide it. But my guess is that in this case, it's something like safety glasses or safety shoes. And for that, again, this is the difference between an at-will work environment versus a unionized work environment. If you were in a unionized work environment, that sort of thing is very commonly found in union contracts about the employer being responsible for providing the PPE.
Okay. Thanks for that question, Roberto. We've got about 5 minutes left, Mike, and I wanted to talk about the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act that took effect in June. Can you tell us some basics on that one?
Oh, sure. So it's been around fairly recently, and recognizing that there are more and more women in the workplace who get pregnant and then want to continue to work through their pregnancy, it created sort of a light version of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So under the Americans with Disabilities Act, if you have a disability, your employer is obligated to make reasonable accommodations for you, and there's a involved procedure that one might follow for that. So what the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act did is say that if someone has a condition associated with their pregnancy that requires an accommodation, the employer has a similar responsibility to accommodate it. So some of the examples, if you have a pregnant employee who works behind a checkout counter and it's because of her pregnancy, it hurts to stand for 8 hours a day, this employee might request a chair, and now under the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, the employer is required to provide that accommodation. The ability to take bathroom breaks during the day, the ability to keep a bottle of water at your workstation. So accommodations like that, you don't have to prove that you have a disability, so it doesn't have to interfere with one or more of your major life functions. It really just has to be a known limitation associated with pregnancy. So the limitations associated with pregnancy are fairly well known. And really the only requirement is that the employee inform their employer of the limitation and to request the accommodation. There is a protection against an undue burden. So if you say, well, based on my pregnancy, I need to have a massage chair at my desk. That might be nice, but that might rise to the level of an undue burden.
Sure.
But they might get you a more comfortable regular chair or something to that effect.
Compromise may be made.
Yes, it is a deliberative process. It's a two-way conversation between the employer and the employee to figure out exactly what accommodations need to be made. But that was a nice addition for employees, particularly pregnant employees.
Sure. So the final word, Mike, if someone's having a problem with their employee, what's your best advice for them? They take it to HR? Do they take it further? Or what's the best first step?
The best first step is generally going to be to talk to your HR department. Oftentimes, particularly in small to medium-sized workplaces, the individual managers don't have very much training at all about employment law. They don't have very much training. They don't have very much training about the best practices when it comes to managing employees. And oftentimes, just a talk with the HR department is enough to fix the problem. So that should really be everybody's first step.
Sure. Makes total sense. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been quite a lesson. I can tell you're a teacher. And thank you for unpacking all this, because it is very confusing. So we'll have you back and we can talk some more. Mike Kent is a labor and employment attorney, and for 20 years he's taught employment law and labor relations at Madison Area Technical College. And just a reminder, our discussion today is intended as general information and should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. Stay with us. We're going to talk about shipwrecks on the Great Lakes.
There once was a ship that put to sea, and the name of the ship was the Billy O.T. The winds blew harder, bowed it down below.
Oh my gosh, what is it about shipwrecks that sparks our interest? You know, most people just love to learn about them. And if you are one of them, we want to tell you about a great event that's coming up called the Ghost Ships Festival in Manitowoc. It's at the end of the month. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. And here to talk about the event and Great Lakes shipwrecks in general are Kevin Cullen, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You bet. And with Kevin is Brendan Baylud. He's the president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association. Hi, Brendan.
Good to be here.
What questions do you have about shipwrecks? Well, give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. Guys, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Brendan, tell us about the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, and I have to admit that I didn't know there was one, so I apologize.
That's all right. We're an organization that is about 35 years old. We were started right around the time that the state of Wisconsin started their maritime archaeology program. Big event happened in 1987. A federal law gave ownership of all shipwrecks in the Great Lakes to the states and provinces, essentially protecting them from illegal salvage. There had been laws on the books before that, but really it was in 1987 that the whole landscape changed. And so the states started either underwater sanctuaries for shipwrecks, or in our case, we started a maritime archaeology program, and the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association was started as their auxiliary volunteer group to help document shipwrecks. And so we've continued to grow and to expand. Now our emphasis is on a lot of remote sensing using sonar and remote operated vehicles to help the public participate in underwater archaeology and in documenting shipwrecks. So we've got about 150 members from all over the state, and we have regular projects where we take people out on the water to investigate, in some cases, newly discovered shipwrecks with us.
That's pretty exciting stuff. Kevin, why don't you tell us about the Wisconsin Maritime Museum? I've been there a couple of times. Really nice museum. What's the behind the making of that museum?
Right. Well, you know, we started off as the Manitowoc Maritime Museum back in 1970, and that really was a kind of a smaller museum, really, you know, heralding the shipbuilding tradition of Manitowoc, and in particular was the World War II effort. And so that's why USS Cobia, the submarine, was actually brought here from Milwaukee, but it was built in Groton, Connecticut. And today it's still here outside in the river. And it's one of the most intact World War II submarines that you can see anywhere in the world, Gato class. So really it grew from a submariner's memorial to a regional maritime museum. And now it's, I would say, a world class, one of the largest maritime museums on the Great Lakes. So lots of exhibits, an incredible archive, and just a tremendous place to come to work every day.
I'll bet. It's a lot more extensive than I thought it was going to be when I first went. It's like, oh, well, this will take, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes. Like, yeah, no. So let's talk about this Ghost Ships Festival. And this sounds like a great time, too. Brendan, your organization's, of course, your organization is co-sponsoring it, and it's going to be in Manitowoc. What are people going to see when they go?
Well, the Ghost Ships Festival actually was started in 2000 in Milwaukee. This is the 19th Ghost Ships Festival. It used to be much larger. We used to get 1,000 people at it when it was in Milwaukee, but we had to move because of costs, really. But what we do is we bring together people who work to locate historic shipwrecks around the Great Lakes, people who tell the stories of historic shipwrecks, who document these new sites as they're discovered. And people who tell stories about the community history associated with these wrecks. And we have a slate of speakers, essentially, throughout the day. Some are noted authors. We'll have the noted regional author Fred Stonehouse is coming to sign his 50th anniversary book about the loss of the Edmund Fitzgerald, for example. But we will also be featuring a revealing of a new discovery of a major ship that was still missing on Lake Superior. one of the largest ships still missing on the Great Lakes has been found, and it will be unveiled at the Ghost Ships Festival as part of our keynote speaker. We'll also have other things. We have a lot of sponsors and vendors, people selling everything from books to scuba diving equipment, people with displays about remote sensing technology, like remote operated vehicles, side scanning sonars. We'll actually have our own remote operated vehicles in the swimming pool, and we'll have a station where the public can pilot our remote operated vehicles around a virtual shipwreck and learn how to use a remote operated vehicle in the hotel pool. We have many other things. We have an author's table where we'll have notable authors doing book signings throughout the event. We'll have a virtual reality cave where people can wear an Oculus 3D VR headset and literally walk down the deck of a historic schooner in 260 feet of water off Wisconsin's coast in real 3D. So just all sorts of opportunities. We'll have merchandise for sale. We'll have people can go and tour the Wisconsin Maritime Museum because it's right next door. A lot of opportunities for people that are interested in maritime history, scuba diving, underwater archaeology, and remote sensing.
What are the dates? Because I know people are probably thinking, come on, give us the dates.
Sure. It's going to be Friday, February 28th and Saturday, March 1st. Friday's show is free to the public. It's sponsored by the Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast National Marine Sanctuary, which is our new federally designated NOAA National Marine Sanctuary here in Wisconsin. And they are sponsoring, like I say, the Friday night show. So, you know, it's free to come in to the shows. And then Saturday, admission is $25 for the main show. We'll be having a box lunches brought in with food trucks. So you don't have to go and leave if you don't want to. And then we have the hotel bar, the shipwreck or the ghost ships pub, which will be open to festival attendees. We have special ghost ships glasses, and if you buy one, you get money off your drinks. So
it is
family. It's a lot of cool stuff for young people to see with the technology and the shipwrecks.
So are you going to be offering grog because and rum, right? Is that what you're?
At the Sub Pub Bar, I think they named it the Ghost Ships Pub on Maritime Bay because of our festival. They actually named the pub after this festival, so that's pretty cool.
They did.
Well, that's pretty cool. So, Kevin, the museum is hosting the welcoming reception. What are any of the, do you have special exhibit going on that people will want to check out?
Yeah, certainly, especially associated with the Ghost Ships Festival. There's relatively new exhibit we opened just last spring, and it's Wisconsin Shipwreck Coasts exhibit. It's over 3,000 square feet and features numerous shipwrecks within Wisconsin waters, but really focusing on the National Marine Sanctuary, Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast. So that's really between Port Washington and Two Rivers. And within that span of water, about 100,000 square miles, is close to about 100 shipwrecks, 40 of them known. And within that space, we have really just incredible artifacts that were brought up in the years before the salvage law, as Brendan mentioned, in 1987, by area divers with the intention of starting their own museum. Some of them did, and they kind of folded, and it's hard to run a museum, as I can attest. But, you know, having a facility like the Wisconsin Maritime Museum and our relationship with NOAA and the Wisconsin Historical Society and with WUAA, WUA, this is a really wonderful period in time, I think, when we're realizing that, you know, we have facilities that can care for these objects. We have huge amount of scholars that are actually studying this material. And now for us to give it to the public in a space that they can learn about these objects, about the stories of these ships, who were on them, where they were going, and our role in American history and ultimately the building of the Midwest and the Upper Great Lakes. And so this is a really great exhibit that is I think going to make some people really realize that we have a special thing here in Wisconsin when it comes to maritime heritage.
Definitely. Now, this exhibit, I'm assuming, is going to go on longer than the festival.
Yes. Yeah. So it's, you know, we intend to keep it as a semi-permanent exhibit, but keep updating new shipwreck stories, new artifacts that we can rotate in and out. The museum recently received a collection of over 10,000 shipwreck artifacts. that we're caring for on behalf of the state of Wisconsin and in consultation with Wisconsin Historical Society. So, you know, with over 10,000 objects, we can only put out a few hundred at a time, and we'll like to be able to take them off exhibit. So this, it's intended to be an adaptive space over the years to come, and really with these partnerships and new discoveries, add new content into that exhibit.
Now, Brendan, is with these new laws, does that mean that we're never going to be bringing up another artifact from these wrecks?
Well, not necessarily, but I would say that we've found that the best place for a lot of these artifacts to remain is in the water. There's been a lot of experience with bringing up, we brought up a whole ship in 1969, the Alvin Clark out of Green Bay. It was put on display in Marinette, but it takes so much money to preserve a ship like that, especially because the metal starts to crack, the wood starts to rot. The Alvin Clark was eventually bulldozed and hauled away to a landfill. And so we've learned from hard experience that these artifacts underwater have a shelf life of hundreds of years. Brought to the surface, they have a shelf life of 20, 30 years. So there is a pathway to recovering artifacts, but it requires the approval of the State Historical Society's State Historic Preservation Officer, the underwater archaeologist. There has to be a conservation plan. There has to be an institution that is willing to accept responsibility for it, and so forth. So the short answer is they can be brought up, but not without extremely good cause and good funding and a good, really cultural case for why we should bring that, you know, out of the water.
That ship up in Marinette is a really good example. I was lucky enough to tour it when I was younger, and just to have it disappear, I mean, it was just a heartbreak. So it's nice that we do have these ways of keeping these artifacts safe. We're talking today with Brendan Baland, president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, and Kevin Cullen, executive director of the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. Do you have any questions about either one of these organizations or shipwrecks in general? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show, and I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. We're going to be getting ready for Valentine's Day, talking about chocolate, jewelry, and flowers. And that, of course, starts at 11. Right now, we are talking about shipwrecks and a really cool festival that's coming up in Manitowoc at the end of the month. It's the Ghost Ships Festival. And I believe you've got Tamara Thompson talking. She's the maritime archaeologist with Wisconsin and Historical Society. What's she going to be talking about, Kevin?
Well, as our state underwater archaeology program is, I think, one of the leading programs, I would say, of any state in the country, with the most shipwrecks nominated to the National Register of Historic Places. And the bulk of those, over 80 now, have been really under the leadership and research from Tammy Thompson. So really, her talk is focused on newly discovered shipwrecks just last year. Every year, it seems like there's more and more being discovered, and that's through organizations like WUAA. Brendan and I were part of one recently. And, you know, so seeing how organizations like ours work with the Wisconsin Historical Society to come in and then do the professional underwater archaeological survey work is really this wonderful partnership. And Tamara's research, and with their team down there, Kendra Kennedy and even their volunteer groups, working together, Zach Wittrock, to bring in new technology like photogrammetry, where you can then map a shipwreck within one dive using thousands of photographs. And it's that data that makes it publicly accessible and have a quick turnaround to have a something to present on, like at Ghost Ships Festival, is just really exciting. So I don't know, 1 hour is probably not enough time for Tammy to go through all the wrecks that they worked on last year, but it really will provide, I think, the casual viewer or interested in this, or may have seen a headline, just to understand the tremendous work that goes into documenting and preserving these shipwrecks.
Now, Brendan, you found one of those shipwrecks, am I right? A tugboat?
Well, in the past 3 years, I found three significant shipwrecks.
Sorry. I didn't give you as much credit.
Well, they've all made a lot of a pretty big splash. The Trinidad we found last year was a perfectly intact two-masted schooner in 260 feet of water. And it was really rather dramatic because the deckhouse was still on it. It still had the dishes stacked in the cupboards inside the cabin from 1881. And it had a tremendous story associated with it. The captain, the builder, the whole story was really quite dramatic. So we immediately brought the state in and they surveyed the wreck, and it's already on the National Register of Historic Places. We'll be giving 3D virtual reality tours of it at the festival. But then this spring, we found with Kevin the schooner Margaret A. Muir off of Algoma. It was a salt-carrying two-masted schooner of about 140 feet length. It broke up in a huge storm just off of Algoma, trying to make the harbor. The only casualty, unfortunately, was the captain's dog. They had to row to shore in about 15-foot waves in a small open boat, barely survived. That ship has been sitting right off the harbor in 50-some feet of water since 1892. Thousands of boats go over it every year, salmon fishing, and nobody ever noticed it. We did historical research on the loss to locate exactly where we thought it was, and then using a side-scanning sonar, that is a very high-resolution archaeological mapping sonar, we located its remains, which are all there. It's just disarticulated and opened up. So a very important site for maritime archaeology, because it shows exactly how these vessels were built. And then, of course, we found then this fall the John Evanson, a little 50-foot wooden tugboat, a steam tug that was actually a small reward for her discovery, because the local dive clubs had been trying to find her. And again, we went to the historical record, to primary sources. We found some official wreck reports at the National Archives. And then we were able to use our remote sensing technology, our high-resolution archaeological sonar, to just cover the bottom in the grid where we knew she probably was. And I think it took us 5 minutes. We ran her over pretty quickly. We had all sorts of food and supplies for the whole weekend, and then we didn't know what to do. We found her immediately.
I'll bet you managed to find something to do.
We did.
So, Kevin, how has all of this equipment and all of this new technology changed the way that people looking for shipwrecks do their job?
Yeah, so really it began, you could think about really the era of shipwreck discovery in the Great Lakes, going back to really the 1960s. A lot of this was equipment that was used really post-World War II, very rudimentary radar systems, in fact, that people like Kent Bell Richard, who's still around in Milwaukee, found some very famous shipwrecks, the Ralph Simmons Christmas tree ship, the SS Milwaukee, which I believe is going to be one of the topics at Ghost Ships Festival. But that was very rudimentary. It was even paper readouts. You would see a kind of a blip almost, on the paper readout of where there would be potentially an anomaly that could be a shipwreck or not. So it took trained eyes. But since, within the last 10 years, you could say, the technology has really advanced to the point of sonars, like side scan sonar, which again has been around a while, but the resolution has gotten so much better. And I would say even the cost has come down enough that organizations like Wisconsin Underwater Archaeological Association can afford to and even modify these sonar units without having to get a massive grant to be able to do the survey work. So within a day or so, as Brendan was saying, with good research, with the right technology, and a bit of time, you can actually now discover new shipwrecks that we thought weren't possible years before. So, that coupled with photogrammetry, again, with processor capabilities in the computers, now the rendering of these shipwreck sites are almost instantaneous. So in his, early times, even just as I was learning underwater archaeology, it was all about mapping. And we still do that using measuring tapes and slates and going down with, Mylar underwater writing paper and a pencil. And, we still do that, but we don't have to map an entire shipwreck that way as much anymore. We can use it to do precise measurements to get room and space of the frame, so we understand, okay, this is probably this vessel. So it's almost like ground truthing it. So, you know, from, again, modern technology to using old school methods, to this day, we're getting just a huge glimpse as to what the kind of vessels plied the waters and exactly what they are in much more definite detail.
Brendan, you had mentioned about the research before you went out. Obviously, all of the time went into that. Where do you go to find out about where these ships possibly could have sunk?
So around 25 years ago, I started to develop a personal database of every ship that was lost in Wisconsin waters. And I did it by, at that time, going to the Milwaukee Public Library and pulling the news microfilms. But as time passed, you know, they started to be digitized and put online. But I kept collecting new wreck accounts of total losses to commercial vessels in Wisconsin waters. Eventually, the database grew to, you know, about 2,000. And then I started to isolate those that I thought were good candidates for discovery. Something many people may not be aware of is the vast majority of the vessels lost in Wisconsin waters were blown onto beaches or onto reefs. And so they're not what we would call a findable shipwreck. These are shipwrecks that in many cases do have extant remains buried under a beach, but you're not going to find it. You're not going to scuba dive it. So I isolated only those vessels that went down out in the lake and that hadn't been found yet. And then I I identified 225 of them. There are 225 ships still missing. I shouldn't say just in Wisconsin. This is in Lake Michigan. There are 225 vessels that haven't been found yet. And I identified the top 10 that I thought were findable. Now, there are a lot of big ships that would be really cool to find out there, but they're, you know, in huge search grids. Like, we don't know exactly where they went down. So it's going to take a month of Sundays to find them and a boat that gets, you know, gallons to the mile, not miles to the gallon. So money. So I looked at the wrecks that I thought were findable. And those are the ones that we went after. And they were findable, and we're still going after them. We go to do original research. A lot of it can be done online now. There are a lot of online databases. You have to know where they are. Wisconsin Maritime Museum hosts one of the best, the Metzler database, where you can research literally every vessel that sailed the lakes in the 1800s is in that database with its dimensions from its enrollment documents from the National Archives. But we also do some original research. I'll go to the National Archives office in Chicago. I'll pull court case documents. I'll pull wreck reports. I'll do a genealogy, full genealogy on the captain and on the builder and on survivors. And I'll locate surviving family members, surviving descendants, and see if there's any family oral tradition about it. And that's always fascinating because in many instances, they didn't know their ancestor was on a shipwreck on the Great Lakes, you know. So that's always a fun thing to do.
Yeah, I can't. This has been a passion for quite a while.
Oh, yeah. Since I was a young man.
Where did it come from?
Well, I grew up on Lake Superior up in the copper country of Michigan, the Keweenaw Peninsula. And we had a couple of old schooners, hulks, just off the house. And I used to snorkel them and clean the fishing lures off and sell them in town for a buck a piece. And when I got to be a teenager, I started wondering what were these two wooden ships doing in the lake off our house? What stories did they have to tell? How'd they end up here? Who sailed on these? Nobody knew. I'd asked everybody. Nobody knows, just the old hulks. And so I went to the local newspaper microfilms there and researched them. And it turned out they were some of the most historic vessels on Lake Superior, and they had been abandoned there after wrecking. And I wrote up their history and published it in the local paper when I was, I think, 17, and I got hooked. There were just so many wrecks up there, so much cool stuff on the bottom of the area, of the waterway there, because it was an old copper mining area. It was like an underwater museum. And turns out many harbors on the Great Lakes are like that. There's just so much undiscovered stuff. You know, and so I got a side-scanning sonar and started to map, you know, old river bottoms, old lakes, and just the amazing amount of stuff and untold stories that are there was overwhelming. I made it a lifelong passion.
What about you, Kevin? How did you get started in this?
Probably the smell of the Irish Sea when I was a child.
I thought I detected a little bit of Irish in your accent.
Yeah, once upon a time. My mother's from Wisconsin, which is why we came here, but we didn't come on a boat as many of immigrants did back in the 1850s, certainly to the Great Lakes. But yeah, no, it really did. I think it really began in the coastal waters of Ireland on the River Shannon, you know, and I lived there in County Galway. But coming to Wisconsin, though, really was actually when I started enrolling in university at Wisconsin-Madison and anthropology and studying archaeology, and realized the Great Lakes and its maritime heritage, which is so vast. I spent time in South Asia and India, and also realized this global maritime community. So I actually got scuba certified at Hoofers in Madison there. And that's when we started going out to dive on shipwrecks in Lake Michigan. And then I realized this is an amazing collection, as Brendan said, underwater museums in and of themselves. And that Great Lakes freshwater preservation is just unparalleled, really, in many parts of the world. And this shipwreck century, really, between, you could say, 1830s and 1930s is what keeps us kind of this motivation of going after to find new discoveries, because they're just still, only scratching the surface of what's actually been found. So that interest has been, through the parallel path through the museum community from my professional archaeology career to now being able to dovetail that with curation and exhibits and now storytelling at our museum here at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum.
That's wonderful. Dream come true for both of you. Brendan, you had mentioned that you grew up in Lake Superior, and of course, one of the, if not the most famous shipwrecks is the Edmund Fitzgerald, which, sank 50 years ago in November. What are you doing at the festival to commemorate that?
We've got a couple of speakers that were very involved in documenting the Edmund Fitzgerald's history. Fred Stonehouse, like I mentioned, will be there. And Rick Mixter, who has written extensively about the Edmund Fitzgerald and has actually been down on her on a number of occasions back when that was still going on with submarines, will be giving a talk about all the different investigations that were done on the Edmund Fitzgerald over the years. So really, two really well-known scholars. Plus, we'll be having some commemorative knickknacks that we'll be selling for those who want to pick up a commemorative 50th anniversary etched crystal tumbler. We're a 501c3, so all of anything you spend there goes to further our scientific and educational nonprofit. But yeah, the Edmund Fitzgerald has always had a real draw. I remember the storm well. I was 8 years old, and the waves that were coming in over our pier were the biggest I'd ever seen in my life. And I had nightmares for years after that. These huge waves were coming up at the house because they were literally probably 15, 20 foot waves. I'll never forget it.
Yeah, me either. I was actually in high school and hearing about what had happened. I was in the UP too. It just was so remarkable. It's kind of like, where were you when Kennedy was shot? It was like, where were you when the Edmund Fitzgerald went down? Why do you think it has such a draw for people who, unlike us, were not there? We're not there. Kevin, I'm sure you hear about it a lot at the museum.
Yeah, we do. It's actually one of the most common things. Like, what about... Where's the history of the Edmund Fitzgerald? And why I would say is, well, certainly this, the song has a lot to do with it. The fact that it's also very much, in living memory, as you both just explained, in 1975, there's, it's a living history. And it's the largest and the last real Great Lakes shipwreck that we can really point to. While there's been some small recreational boating, fatalities and disasters, this one rises that occasion of just, the ferocity of the Great Lakes and its tremendous impact in the maritime community in which these vessels are coming from port to port. And of course, it has a very strong Wisconsin connection historically to Edmund Fitzgerald. And of course, then the Northwestern Mutual Foundation and all of the families that are affected and it's their connections to various communities in Wisconsin. So, I think it's just also the discovery itself being, in such deep water, Lake Superior, off of the Canadian coast in Canadian water. But, that also coupled with, modern scuba equipment, it was the Newt suit that was used to go down these, in the 1970s to really understand what the wreck site is like. And when you see it on the bottom, we have an actual model in our model boats gallery of what it looks like, kind of like Titanic, right, where it's flipped over and the iron ore is laid out and it's broken in half. And it is, just this really shows how violent that wreck event was and yet still that it's a tomb site to this day. You know, it's a graveyard. So that I think is what I think people's fascinating interest is, and certainly the lore surrounding it too of actually how that happened is still an open discussion.
Yes, definitely a mystery. And speaking of, you know, you said it was in deep water, but some ships are in pretty shallow water. Why don't you talk about the Griffin? It's kind of been the holy grail for a while, Brendan. But it's just a controversy. Give us some background on that one.
Sure. Oddly enough, I've done a lot of original research into the French period on Lake Michigan, and specifically the La Salle expeditions. The Griffin was the first decked vessel on the Western Great Lakes. She was not the first vessel, nor was she the first shipwreck. La Salle had another vessel, the Frontenac, which wrecked on Lake Ontario the year before. So the Griffin was a fur trading vessel that predated any other decked vessel on the Great Lakes by about 80 years. So a real one-off. This was a vessel that was probably about 45 feet in length. We actually have LaSalle's original letters in his own hand from the French archives, where he discusses the ship and he discusses its loss. So there's not a lot of mystery about the area of the lake it went missing in. It had sailed through the Straits of Mackinac, had stopped at St. Ignace, and then continued on to what we believe to have been Rock Island off the tip of the Door Peninsula. Excellent archaeological study by Ron Mason, a prominent early Wisconsin archaeologist, actually found French graves there that had, you know, 1670s period material in them. So we really do believe that's where the Griffin landed. She left after a few days. Her captain sailed her back. LaSalle and his men got off and continued down the Wisconsin coast. And as LaSalle was crossing Death's Door, an amazingly violent storm hit. Almost capsizing the canoes. That was the next day. That same storm is believed to have been the storm that sank the Griffin. By all accounts, La Salle had sent his men to circumnavigate Lake Michigan and to get news of it. And they had their men had been told by a local native settlement of Potawatomis on the North Shore that they had seen the ship come to anchor in a bay behind a point of land where they were sheltered. And they had warned them not to go out in the storm, but the captain said his ship was not afraid of the wind and he would do as he pleased. And so he sailed out. The second they got out of the lee of the land, they lost steerage. They had to strike all but one of their sails, and then they disappeared, literally vanished in front of the eyes of the Potawatomi. The only thing that was ever found was some debris that washed up on the north shore of Lake Michigan. It was truck of the flagstaff of the vessel, the cabin doors, a hatch combing, and some bales of beaver pelts. And La Salle was shown these, but the vessel was never found. What we believe today, based upon these accounts, is that the Griffin probably did capsize and sink somewhere in northern Lake Michigan. That area is not deep. It's only between about 30 and 80 feet deep. And we think, from what we've seen of other historic wrecks in that area, that it is a debris field. There'll be almost no wood left. And so we expect that it's going to have to be found with a magnetometer. They'll find it because it was carrying anvils, big anvils, to, you know, craft another vessel that was supposed to go down the Mississippi. It has big iron anchors. It had a lot of iron tools. So somebody someday is going to find a big debris field of late 1600s era ironwork on the floor of Lake Michigan in the north end. But I'm not going to hold my breath because that's a needle in a haystack.
Now, what about the couple from Charlevoix that thinks that they found it? What are your thoughts on that? And Kevin?
Well, it seems like there's always a new discovery. and Brendan can probably point to a number of expeditions he's even been on that have claimed it. You know, again, I would say... show me the evidence. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of, you know, oh, I found this just for headlines kind of stories. But as Brendan said, really, the artifacts will at the end of the day, truly speak to that. So a cannon as well, I believe, right, Brendan? There was a couple of number of cannons. So that narrows the scope of your wreck pretty significantly. But I can't speak to that specific, you know.
I'll bet you can, Brendan.
Well, I know them.
Okay.
But, well, I've had him on my podcast, and an excellent researcher. They have solid research. I think where it falls apart is that this isn't the first time they've found a wooden object and said it was the griffin. It also hasn't been substantiated. They tend to bring in experts from France as opposed to experts from the Great Lakes who know what things look like here. I would say that what Kevin said is correct, that they failed to produce the sort of smoking gun evidence that we would expect to see. And also, they're in the right neck of the woods, though. And I do have a lot of respect for their research as historians, but the archaeology is where things kind of fall apart on that one.
We're talking about shipwrecks with Kevin Cullen, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc, and Brendan Bailed, the President of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeological Association. Give us a call at 800-642-123 or send an email to talk@WPR. We'd love to hear your questions and comments. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nagel. We're talking about shipwrecks. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. We're going to be talking about getting ready for Valentine's Day. So we're talking to a chocolatier, a couple of jewelers, and a florist. So hope you can join us for that. You talk about the protections that are out there for these shipwrecks and that now they are protected, but who actually protects them? I mean, it's out in the middle of the lake. So who's going to stop people from looting them?
So the job of protecting shipwrecks is really the Wisconsin DNR, game wardens. It also falls upon really any law enforcement officer, but specifically the DNR is the group that's charged with protecting these, same as with any terrestrial archaeological site that is on public land. That's also the DNR's purview. There are processes before there's, for example, construction done on riverways or on lakeshores. There generally is an archaeological study, and they bring in the State Historical Society's maritime archaeologist to make sure that they're not disturbing any important archaeological remains. The same is done when they build a freeway or a road. It's important to remember that most of our shipwrecks are not out there on the bottom of the lake. They're under beaches, they're in harbors, and in rivers. So that kind of due diligence is important.
We've got a call from Dot in Manitowoc. Go ahead, Dot.
Hello. I was wondering, of all the Great Lakes, which one is the most violent and which one has accumulated the most shipwrecks?
Okay. Which one of you gentlemen knows the answer? I feel like I'm in jeopardy.
Go ahead, Brendan.
I've done some original research on that over the years. So, statistically speaking, the most dangerous of the Great Lakes is Lake Michigan. And this is strictly a function of vessel density and population. Lake Superior has the least. And that's, again, there are no major cities up there. It was cut off from the other lakes until the Sioux Locks were built in 1855. And most of the vessel traffic was in the form of large bulk carriers carrying, you know, coarse freight goods like iron ore and lumber. Lake Michigan had a lot of smaller coastal trading schooners that ran between places like Chicago and, you know, the Eastern Lakes, a lot of grain schooners, and that had a lot of open, unprotected expanses. So if there's a big, and it's also very narrow east to west. So on the ocean, if you get in a storm, you know, you can run before the storm with the wind at your back for days and let it blow itself out. If you try that on Lake Michigan, you'll be in someone's cornfield in 2 hours. So most of the ships were blown ashore, either on the East Coast or the West Coast. But Lake Michigan edges out Lake Erie by a slight bit, and that's because Lake Erie is fairly shallow. A lot of ships sank, but because their masts were breaking the surface, these schooners were pumped out and refloated because Lake Erie is 55, 60 feet deep. Lake Huron, likewise, doesn't have a lot of big cities, so most of the ships there were coming from someplace else and going to someplace else. So Lake Michigan does have a narrow lead. Now, in terms of treachery, I would say it's a toss-up between Lakes Michigan and Erie. Lake Superior can get very rough, but not as rough as Lake Michigan and Lake Erie. They are generally speaking, just treacherous lakes because of their morphology, because of the number of reefs, the lack of open expanses where you can run, like Lake Superior has. They were dreaded by mariners in storm conditions, and particularly Lake Michigan, because it's just, there's nowhere to hide, you know, and nowhere to run.
Let's take another call from Richard in Two Rivers. Go ahead, Richard.
Hi. Hey, I just learned of the Wisconsin, you know, Maritime Historical Society this summer when I noticed some type of object poking out of the sand up in the Two Rivers area. And it turns out it was some type of post they assume was used to rescue boats that were sinking in the sand. They felt it was maybe from a salvage company that tried to pull the boats out, and that many boats just did that. They sunk in the sand right off of the shore out there in Two Rivers. And it was very interesting learning the historical, take on what I found poking out of the sand.
Thanks, Richard. Any comments, guys?
Yeah, I guess I could jump in there because, you know, we get these questions a lot from the community. And certainly, as you've mentioned there, Two Rivers, is Raleigh Point is a well-known bump out into the lake, and it's quite shallow, quite a ways out. And there's a number of shipwrecks right off the shore there. And so that's part of the National Marine Sanctuary's Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast for that reason. And so really what we tried to do is steer people to identify those. So the caller was absolutely correct. And, you know, raising an eyebrow and maybe, oh, this looks not natural. Could it be part of another one of those shipwrecks? And, you know, not often they are wrecks, but they are associated with the maritime cultural landscape. And that could be also a pier. It could be related to commercial fishing. It could be World War II when they landed Sherman tanks there on those landing craft tanks when they were doing amphibious invasion training. So there's all of this part of, you know, the coast and the shoreline speaks to a particular period. And you might just be lucky enough to actually have come across something that is, in fact, part of a historic schooner. And it's important for us to document those. And so what we do is send callers or people interested or curious to the Wisconsin Historical Society and the state archaeologist office, and they can then manage the process with the DNR to make sure that they're recorded accurately. And WUA, Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, could come in and help map a project that maybe could become then a citizen science public maritime archaeology project and survey. And that we've been doing for over 30 years, since 1990.
Great. Thanks for that call, Richard. I appreciate it. You know, talking about citizen science, Brendan, your organization, the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, does some things like that. So why don't you tell us a little bit how people who maybe are not scuba divers can get involved in your organization?
Sure. The best way to get involved with us and to learn more about us is to go to our website, wuaa.org. And, you know, read about some of the projects we've done. We send out a monthly member update about all the projects that we have coming up and all the trainings we have coming up for people. And depending upon where you are, or your level of interest, we almost always have something for everybody. Some people want to be involved just by doing research projects. We have a couple of projects where we're transcribing vessel wreck reports from the National Archives to be able to put in an online database. We have a project where we're transcribing early vessel accident lists, you know, to make this data, to compile data. But some of our bigger projects are remote sensing projects. We have, for example, one that we have planned is at Two Rivers Point, where there is an old schooner, a bunch of old schooner frames that are in the surf line right off of the Raleigh Point Lighthouse. And they're buried deeply under the beach. One of the things we want to do is bring in a magnetometer, which is a device that measures, that can detect iron deep under the sand by using the Earth's magnetic field. Instead of like a metal detector that will only go a foot deep, this will detect iron bodies, you know, 10 feet under the sand. What we want to do is put flags in the beach wherever we get a hit, and then we run a piece of string around the outline, and we can see exactly how big this piece of ship is, and we measure it, and it can tell us a lot about what ship it is. There's also a big piece of it, we think, out under the bottom of the lake, about maybe 50 yards out. We want to map that as well using the magnetometer, dropping floats. and we'll also measure that. So we'll get to have a good idea of what's under the bottom. And that's a good public participation project. You know, we'll bring a barbecue grill, we'll bring, you know, have a picnic and put up a tent and have a good fun time. We have other projects similar. We're going out to look for a new shipwreck this spring. We're going to probably rent a fairly large boat and bring a pretty good number of people out there. We'll show that they'll be able to go shipwreck hunting with us, and we'll use our side scan sonar to map this piece of bottom, and we believe we will find the ship we're looking for. And so, you know, our members who I think we've pretty much filled that one, but with many projects like that, we try to do at least two projects a year where we get a significant number of people that can participate. And then we also train people to use our side scan sonar and to use our remote operated vehicle. And if you have a project and you want to use those, you have to have obviously a WUA docent who will be along to maintain the equipment, but you can actually use our equipment. If you're a member and you propose a project and you have a good project design, we'll make it a WUA project and go and look for whatever you want to look for.
What great opportunities. Kevin, what about you? How do volunteers help you at the museum?
Well, we're always looking for volunteers. Any museum is, you know, but really for us, it's, you know, a variety of things. Helping on the submarine, of course, you know, that's its own history and important preservation project. But within collections, we have a number of volunteers that help weekly come in and help with archives, documenting new donations within the exhibit galleries too, as a docent, but ways that, you know, education, the public that wanna, you know, learn more about the maritime heritage of Wisconsin. I mean, that's our mission, connecting all people to Wisconsin's waterways. And various folks have different ways that they identify with that. And if it's, again, commercial fishing, which you have a new exhibit about currently, that's one avenue. Or if it is those beachcombers that are looking for things and they want to learn a bit more about what was the ghost port that used to be there. You know, really, that's what our organization set up for. And with WUIA, similarly, you know, because when we find these shipwreck sites, they are become these landmarks off of these communities that they can now connect with and understand a bit more about that community's role in the peopling of the Great Lakes. And that's, you know, a story that's always changing, and we're excited to kind of help articulate a chapter or two in that complicated history.
Okay. Well, we've only got a few minutes left. Brendan, why don't you give us the rundown on that festival again and where we can get tickets and how much are they and et cetera.
Sure. If you want to join us at the Ghost Ships Festival in Manitowoc, it's going to be Friday, February 28th and Saturday, March 1st at the Inn on Maritime Bay. That's right across the parking lot from the Wisconsin Maritime Museum. So if you join us, you can visit the museum and you'll get a $10 discount on your admission to the museum. If you want to buy tickets, they're $25 if you want to go Saturday. The Friday night show, which is shorter, it starts at 6 o'clock and runs until about 8, is free. It's being sponsored by our partner, the Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast National Marine Sanctuary. If you want to buy tickets, they're $25 a piece. You can go to www.ghostshipsfestival.com. That is where you will find tickets. We still have some booths available for vendors. They're going fast. If you want to sign up for a booth. And we also have sponsorship opportunities. And I guess it's probably a good idea to get your tickets sooner than later, because we do think we could fill up this year.
I have a feeling after today, you probably will get really close. We have a lot of shipwreck lovers that like to listen to the show. So I want to thank you both for what you do for the history of the state and for coming on today and sharing your knowledge with us. I hope we'll have you on again.
Thank you, Jill. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Kevin Cullen is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc, and Brendan Bayland is President of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association. I want to thank you for listening. This and all our other shows, of course, are a team effort. She'd not been 2 weeks from shore when down on her right whale bore.
The captain called all hands and swore he'd take that whale in tow. Soon may the wellerman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go.